I'm putting a squad together. I need an Indian guide who knows the territory.
Oh. Who's the lucky winner this time? Well, good luck.
That's all you got?
Sarge, the whole town's underwater. And you're grabbing a bucket when you should grab a bathing suit. You know?
Come on, Jerry, what the hell happened to you?
Hey, same thing that happened to you, pal. But the war's over, and we don't have to fight anymore. You're not gonna change anything around here, Sarge. You're just gonna wake up one morning walking on the wrong side of the grass. For what?
You can't answer that question. Take off the badge. Drink up.
Okay, but only because it sounded like an order.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me, as always, are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Hello.
And Dave Trumbore.
What's up?
Today we're getting all mobbed up. We'll be talking about gangster films. We'll be talking about their history. And more importantly, why do we find them so interesting and how have they persevered over time? And then that will lead us into our discussion of this weekend's new release, Gangster Squad. So let's get right to it. Gangster films have been one of the staples of cinema. We can't really, I don't want to say get rid of them, but gangster movies are sort of different than, let's say, Westerns. Westerns have kind of died off. And that's not to say we've been getting gangster movies hand over fist, but there's something about gangster film, like the gangster genre, that we just find incredibly captivating and also critically acclaimed. Some of the most critically acclaimed works over time are The Godfather and The Sopranos. So both in film and in television, people like seeing gangsters, especially for Italian gangsters, and that mob. And one of the things I find particularly interesting about the appeal of the gangster genre is that I feel that America is a very individualistic nation. It's not that it's all about me, 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 but we like the single protagonist. We like the guy who goes up against it, and we especially like the outlaw, the singular outlaw, the guy who goes against it. A gang is... it is a gang. It is multiple people working towards an illegal end and doing so through very dirty methods. This ain't like Ocean's Eleven. It's like, oh, we're all having fun, whatever. These are bad guys that we yet can't look away from. They're not individuals, but they make this group that's sort of at odds with each other, and a mob can't even seem to trust itself. So, yeah, there's drama going on, and yet it seems contrary to what we usually expect when we see an anti-hero, that's probably not the right word, but these illegal figures, these figures who are outside of the rules of society. So why do you guys think that we find the gangster so appealing and that we found him so appealing for so long?
I think the fact that it's part of our nation's history, at least. I mean, there are obviously foreign films that deal with gangsters in their own way. But as far as America goes, since that was sort of the Prohibition era, 20s, 30s, and then extending on into the modern times, there's always sort of that gangster, sort of that underbelly, that seedy crime world that's always there. But the common person, I don't think, really has any connection to it besides going to see these types of gangster movies. So the fact that it's there, the fact that these stories are often based on true events, historical events or historical figures, I think that already makes a good connection with an audience. So you already have something in mind. You already have a character in mind or a certain look, or they're going to use this weapon or they're going to drive this car. You've already got that historical background. So I think that's just a good jumping off point to why these movies are so successful and why they resonate with so many people.
I think the crux of their appeal comes in the fact that the audience likes to root for the bad guy. And with most gangster movies, the good guy is quote unquote the least bad guy, because there's not in most gangster movies, it's not like you've got like a straight-laced by the books guy who's going to like win out in the end and be the hero. I think everyone has that fantasy of, you know, like they want to, you know, take things into their own hands or go outside the law, you know, sometimes rules have to be broken, and I think audiences kind of enjoy seeing that and seeing people bend the rules, which was kind of the crux of Gangster Squad is, you know, these guys aren't straight-laced cops. They're doing it their own way and cleaning up the city.
They play their own rules. Well, Adam, you make a good point about the people who go outside society and yet they're the more interesting characters. I spent last week watching a bunch of older gangster films that came out before 1950. And one of the things that leaped out at me is that these movies are very much in the mold of a societal problem. And it's hypocritical because the gangster in the who's the focus is such a compelling character. You are interested in Paul Muni as Scarface. You want to see what Edward G. Robinson does as Rico. Like they're magnetic. They're really interesting people. And or James Cagney, who was in The Public Enemy and in White Heat. And I watched a film called G-Men, which came out. I wanted to see that because it's like, oh, this might be along the gangster lines of Gangster Squad, where it's a group of cops going against a gangster. G-Men is not that good. G-Men is it's an ad for the FBI. It's like, come join the FBI. James Cagney will show you what's happening. By the way, listeners, that's not the last time during this podcast I'm going to employ my 1930s voice. Like, because everyone talks like that, and I like it. You fall into a rhythm, but they all talk like that. So, because it comes out of vaudeville, and then they just had this sort of speaking style back then, and it's fun. It's fun to do it. Try. It's
still better than Ryan Gosling's voice in Gangster Squad.
What was with that? Like, I don't notice. Isn't that just the way he talks? I didn't notice.
No,
that.
I thought at first,
it completely made sense with the well. We'll get into that
later. All right, we'll get into that later. But what I was going for is back in pre-1950, it's society's problem. And that's partially the production code. You have these really exciting films, but then the production code has to bookend the film and saying, this is bad, and this is what society must do, and don't be like these characters, kids. It's like watching a film. It's like watching Dazed and Confused and then someone saying, don't smoke pot. It's one of those things, like it makes no sense. But then as you get into the 1970s and sort of the Godfather era and sort of Mean Streets, criminals and gangs become more of a family issue. It becomes a lot more personal. It's not about what society must do. It's about what the family must do and the neighborhood must do and people more of their independent circumstances and where they come from rather than this nebulous, like, gangs exist and we have to do something about it. By the 1970s, it's not like the mob is running wild because there's no prohibition anymore. So that historical event is taken out of the picture, but gangs are still captivating. So you have that sort of neat twist on it from the 30s to the 70s.
Yeah, and then as you get into the 90s, it becomes more of that contemporary sort of the 24-hour news cycle. The gangs are more, I don't know, they're more prevalent, I think. At least gang activity kind of takes a different spin from being this kind of cool anti-hero, like you said, to being a real danger that's present in a lot of people's neighborhoods. And we don't really have to get into those types of films too much. I just think it took kind of an interesting turn, probably mid-90s and on. I think we've kind of gotten out of that in the last decade or so, and we've a lot of the movies tend to either go back to those, like the 20s or 30s in the time, or they go back to the Godfather kind of theme, and they try to focus it around the family.
Or they go to Killing Them Softly, where it's like, fuck America, exactly. Drop the mic, walk away. But even in that film, the mob is never present. It's all they're off screen for that whole film. So they take on sort of like a mythic quality, that they're sort of this offstage player, and because we already have a notion of the mob in our heads – when Richard Jenkins is bringing up things like they don't want to pay for it and they're haggling over price, like they seem like more of a corporation than
absolutely.
But I mean, that's sort of the joke. It's
who are the biggest criminals of all?
Exactly. But it's let's get political on the collision. But it's organized crime, and that's sort of going back to what The Godfather, one of the most memorable lines, where Michael tells Kay about how. She's saying, like, you know, politicians and businessmen don't have people killed. And he's, like, saying, now who's being naive? he's like, how different are we really? Because it is sort of this notion, again, of not that the gangs are the society's problem, but a reflection of society. And that's where I think it gets even scarier. And I think that David Chase really picked up on that for The Sopranos, where he made it the American family. It is the American family that just happens to be the mob. It's two families. And so, and that will end, thus endeth the conversation.
Well, no, I was thinking about Lawless too, just going back to recent gangster films. And that's less of a gangster film because they sort of marketed it that way with Gary Oldman's character was
barely in the film.
And he's barely in it. He's in there for 5 minutes. He does some gangstery things, and then he just walks off.
What Lawless does is sort of plays into the 1920s glorification of the gangster, where these gangsters became mythic heroes, your John Dillinger, right. Your Babyface Nelson, these larger than life fiction, larger than life real gangsters, and you mm-hmm. have Tom Hardy at one point tell Shia LaBeouf, look at you walking around like you're Al Capone.
Right.
And Al Capone was alive at that time.
Yeah, Lawless almost works as like a cautionary tale of like, you know, look, this is what happens when you glorify this kind of gangster stuff, and this is how, like, who's the real gangster now? You look at Shia LaBeouf compared to, you know, Tom Hardy. Like, who's the tough guy now?
And so with gangster films in the present day, I mean, I would say the largest gangster entertainment at this point right now is Boardwalk Empire,
right.
Where your tagline is, you can't be half a gangster.
Right.
You can maybe be three-quarters gangster, possibly seven-eighths gangster, but not half. So that's sort of what's running right now, but what are we sort of seeing in the present? Has the gangster genre maybe died down a little? Did I shortchange it a little bit? Are we seeing it about the same level as the Western?
I don't think it's the same level as the Western.
Because I don't know. Squad, like, yeah, there are gangsters in it, but it's almost more of a cop film.
Yeah, I feel like it's morphed into more of a cop movie with and I would go as far back as, like, Reservoir Dogs to be the beginning of – well, obviously, Reservoir Dogs kicked off a lot of copycats and was kind of like a shot of adrenaline to the gangster genre. But now we're seeing movies like, you know, The Departed, stuff where cops are intricately involved, and it's less like a mafia group behind it than kind of infiltration of the police force. And, you know, there's usually some kind of mafia or mob presence, but it's way, way in the background. Like you said, with Lawless, it's more focused on something else.
Well, and also there's a much darker reflection of cops, and even in Gangster Squad, these are cops that do have to fight dirty. That the straight cop is not, there has to be some bent to him, that you just can't be the straight up good guy. Someone has to, you don't
like LA Confidential.
Exactly. Well, I love LA Confidential as a film. I think it's actually better than the book, but it is, and you have that sort of aspect to it. And Mickey Cohen, I believe, is in LA Confidential, much smaller role, it's more of a cameo character. But again, it's sort of playing into these real world events, but the cops have to get dirtier, whereas in these early gangster films where the production code says there's right and there's wrong, even though the entertainment value is subverting that mandate, there's still the cops in those films are like, I'll get you, gangster, eventually. Like, they can't they don't do anything. The cops in those films, except for White Heat, they come off as very smart and methodical cops, and they're honest and they're just straight laced, good to go. But for that's 1949. In the early 1930s, it's just like one guy, it's like telling Scarface, it's like, you'll slip up one day and then we're gonna gun you down. That's all. It's always going to end that way. It's like we're not going to for a film that's holding up Law and Order. If no one gets arrested, they just get gunned the shit down in movies. So even that notion of justice, where it's like mobsters don't really get arrested in their world. Mobsters, there's one way you're getting out, and you're probably going to die. Although it changes a bit with Goodfellas. Paul Sorvino, I think he goes to jail, and doesn't De Niro go to jail, I believe?
I forget who all goes.
De Niro doesn't go. I don't think so.
Okay, I know Pesci fucking gets destroyed.
Yeah.
he gets destroyed in that and Casino.
Yeah, and almost like it's almost like the same situation.
And in Gone Fishing.
No. I don't think so.
Written by J.J. Abrams. I found out that J.J. Abrams also wrote Joyride.
Oh, yeah.
How about that?
Armageddon.
And Armageddon. Let's just change the course on this conversation. Let's talk to J.J. Abrams. Sidetracked. Anyway, so you have Pesci, but Dave, this is going back to sort of what you said about sort of these mm-hmm. different kinds of gangsters, where there's sort of these different levels. Yeah. And Pesci is the I'm a psycho gangster who's going to get the business, whereas going, you know, if we're talking about Casino, De Niro is the reasonable gangster, the one who's like, we have a code here, there is order. And that's sort of the tension in the gangster film, is that someone's going to go outside the lines, where they're all criminals, they're all on the wrong side of the law, but someone has to really fuck up to fuck over the other people on the bad side. It's like, whoa, 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 it's time for you to sleep with the fishes. You never go against the family. That's the thing.
Right, exactly.
They form their own lawful society, whereas you don't get fired, you just get guns the fuck down.
Are never seen again.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of the central conceit of The Sopranos, whereas, you know, it starts out like, oh, it's a gangster show, but it's really about a business, and they have a code and they have rules, and you kind of get that different mix of personalities, of like gangster personalities throughout the series' run, of, you know, the guys that are kind of loose cannons that they know to kind of watch out for, who do something really stupid and they have to take care of it and stuff like that.
Right, but there's also that brutality in there where we see it, and someone who really enjoys their work. Like in the first season episode, College, where Tony Soprano just loves garroting that guy. He's like, I'm going to take my daughter looking at colleges, and I'm also going to kill the shit out of this guy. It's that sort of dichotomy that show likes to play with. And I'll say up front, though, I'm not one of those diehard Sopranos fans. It's a show that I respect what it does, but I think sometimes its narrative structure.
Well, you're not a fan of like the novelized television, like Mad Men and stuff like that, though.
That's true, and Boardwalk Empire, and
Well, I can't get through Boardwalk. I love Sopranos and Mad Men, but I can't get
Boardwalk
through
Empire. Boardwalk Empire is so fucking slow. I mean, going to Ganks in the second season. The second season starts off, and I stopped watching at the beginning. But it's like, which corrupt official is going to win? It's like, who gives a shit? Why would it be just different? It's like
watch Sons of Anarchy instead, and you'll be okay.
Watch Sons of Anarchy. Yeah. Well, there's a gang, motorcycle gang. How about that?
Yeah.
Well, that's
I actually like the more contemporary one. So I like the sort of the Guy Ritchie approach to it, where it's like everybody's a bad guy, just at different levels.
Different levels,
and some are funnier than others.
Exactly.
So
there's
we'll just
more
see
flair
who survives
there.
At the end
there's some. It's not just dark comedy. It's more of an absurdist take, whereas things are just bouncing off the walls because it's so high strung. And kind of pointing out the ridiculousness of it. And I would say that there is a level of silliness, because you have these sort of organizations that take themselves very seriously, and yet for the amount of work that they put into it, couldn't they be legit? And I think that's part of the reasons that these older gangster films in the 30s and the 70s start to fade a bit, because there is a cultural aspect that says that immigrants, that these races, these ethnicities are forced into these circumstances simply by birth, that it's not only a family business, it is a business where they couldn't go legit if they wanted to. And again, going back to The Sopranos, there's that opportunity there to sort of give the business off, but it's like, do you want to be part of something? You have a choice, whereas going back to like the 30s, it's you want the glamour of it, and yet you also don't have much of a choice, because I look at Scarface and I'm like, what the hell else is Paul Mooney gonna, like, what is Tony going to do in that film? And even at the remake of Scarface, Brian De Palma, although that is a much, much weaker film.
Yeah.
You have, Tony Montoya is, that's his name, right?
Tony Montoya.
Tony Montoya. He's a minority. And that's what you have to do. And so the appeal of gangs also does appeal in the sense of it's a minority thing. You don't really see like the up-class white people gang. When you see white people in a gang, they're still like European. Like they're white trash, like they're Euro trash gangs. They're sort of, if you want to be a gang of like upstanding, like there's no WASP gang.
Yeah.
There should be.
that's the corporation.
Exactly, that's the corporation. They don't have to resort to dirty means, or rather, their crimes are so big they can't be prosecuted. They're above it. And that's where it gets really infuriating. And so there's almost a bit of a tragedy. Yeah, there, and not a tragedy, but it's amusing because if you were to look at the recent financial scandals, some of them resemble mob tactics.
Absolutely,
like paying protection or there's that kind of similarity.
Or buying off politicians or buying off votes or buying off.
Exactly, and it goes straight to what Michael Corleone says. It's not that different and isn't that disturbing.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
But if it's disturbing, then why do we like watching gangster films?
I don't know. I think
not that people don't like being disturbed, but people go
to
be gangster films to be entertained. Like
people
want to see gangster films that like are they don't want to see Killing Them Softly.
Yeah.
They don't want to see films that like make them feel sad. They want to see gangster films where they're powerful. I mean, The Godfather isn't a laugh a minute joyride, but it's still entertaining. And so and that's part of its longstanding appeal of it gets that balance right of a film that'll entertain you, but it doesn't feel like preaching. And so you get there. So again, there is a quality of the direction of it as well. We can't just take filmmakers and actors out of the equation and say all the gangster films are gold.
Definitely not true. Like Public Enemies. I don't think we've mentioned that yet.
God.
You take like the actual historical figures, but that picture was just so bleak. Like there was no kind of, I don't know, there wasn't any joy to be had by anybody.
There's no
whether
joy.
You were in the picture
it's
in
shot
the audience.
Terribly. The pacing is crap.
Digital.
It's that's a huge disappointment. Which is kind of funny when you consider that Michael Mann made Heat, which is a great crime.
That was like
film.
A thing when Public Enemies was coming out. It was so exciting because like that cast and Michael Mann.
Yeah, way to go, man. Why don't you go murder more horses?
Seriously.
So there's sort of that element. I think we still want the gangsters. We still want them. But the question is do we want, you know, where do we want our gangsters? And we haven't even, Dave, you touched on it briefly, or maybe it was Adam. I don't know who to give credit to. But the overseas gangsters, sort of, you see that in French cinema.
A lot of Asian cinema too. Yeah.
Exactly, and there's different
Yakuza and things like that.
Right.
Well, The Departed's a remake of
Internal Affairs, Infernal Affairs. Yeah.
I think it's Infernal
Affairs.
Affairs.
Yeah, and it's a much better movie. And it is. So, but those even have their own sort of styles, whereas the French films are, being French, very meditative, and I mean not meditative, but they're very sort of brooding and intense. There's like sort of this underlying tension, whereas Asian films are like, shoot every motherfucker in the room. Kill everybody. That's sort of, they're more fun that way. And then British gangster films, I would say, are almost on the comic side.
Absolutely.
You know, it's that SNL skit, Don't You Go Running Around a Reroute. You can't understand them, but you know that the gangsters are in there. And there's that great tradition, too, of sort of in the 70s you have, like, Get Carter, and in the 80s you have it's Mona Lisa. I still haven't seen The Long Good Friday, but you have that. And then, as Dave, you were saying, sort of the Guy Ritchie stuff of late, of how that sort of gangster upbeat vibe. So you're getting different places, and I think it's interesting that gangster films come from different countries, because it's a stranger element to take, because a Western always usually takes place in the American West. It is localized, but we were just saying crime, these gangs are cultural. They're cultural outgrowths. And so you have to look at each individual culture and see where they're coming from, which I think is more complex and also more interesting.
Yeah, I think one of the more recent ones that didn't get a whole lot of play whatsoever, it's called Kill the Irishman, and it actually takes a look at the sort of the Irish mafia that happened to be working under the Italian mafia here in the States. I think this one actually took place in Cleveland. This was all based on actual events too. Something like, I can't remember the guy's name, Danny Green, I think was his name. He rose to the top of the Irish mafia and sort of rebelled against the Italian mafia. Mm-hmm. And there was something like 60 car bombs or attempts on his life over the course of like one summer. So a pretty fantastic film just to like get a little bit of education on sort of that side of the gangster spectrum.
Now,
it's something you don't see too often stateside.
Right. I what's also interesting about the gangster genre is kind of contradict myself a little bit. There is that protagonist still. There's the gang and the appeal of the gang. But there is that one sort of colorful character. There's that one who disrupts the order of it by either going too far or trying to get out. So you have people who testify against it. So you have Henry Hill in Goodfellas. And you have Michael Corleone basically tries to get away and then is reabsorbed into the family.
But right.
There is someone who tries to break free of that orbit and yet is then drawn back in or dies. Again, there's no one really gets away. I mean, except for Henry Hill, but even then he doesn't really get away because he's like, fuck my life.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
well, and you see that in play out in the season two of The Wire with the they don't really say the like actual nationality of the crime syndicate, but you could even consider season two of The Wire like a mini gangster.
We call them the Greeks, but even though
he's called the Greek, but he says I'm not even Greek, so
right. But they're,
who knows where they're actually from? But that acts as like another mini version of a gangster film, and you see in the season of that show what happens when people want out. In a more kind of realistic fashion. It's not like, oh, well, you know, that person's automatically dead. They do what they can to bring him back in.
Well, exactly. And it's also it's more business minded where it's more of that, no one's leaving a message. No one's like Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes. No one's doing that. It's like, this dude's fucking dead. I'm not giving you a clue. He'll say, hey, what's up? I just murdered this guy. I mean, that's sort of the more colorful aspect of the mafia, where I'm sending messages, sending dead mail to let my enemies know that I'm not fucking around. That's one of the more – I always liked that as well. I always like decorative killers, like people – even in anything. In serial killers, it's like, not only am I going to murder someone, I'm going to take the time to just dress it up a little bit, because you can really do some nice things if in the murder – like, you don't need to get away from your crime, do you? If you've got a little extra time, maybe paint the walls with blood. Decoupage. God. It's that kind of –
this guy
put a head in a box, whatever.
Exactly. It's just but again, there is that level of sending a message as a show of strength. Mm-hmm. There is that level of tell your bosses I'm not screwing around, because,
well, that's dramatic license.
It is dramatic license. I mean, it is.
Makes it more fun. Yeah.
Yeah, and absolutely. And we see that at the beginning of Gangster Squad in one of the film's best moments, where Mickey Cohen, played by Sean Penn, deals with a guy who he doesn't really like.
And yeah, way to establish who's the bad guy right off the bat. It's like, there's no...
Well, you know what it established for me right off the bat? I'm like, oh, right, this film is rated R. I didn't know. I didn't know if it was PG-13
or R. Remember that.
It's like, yep, rated R. So, from the director of Zombieland. Do you guys want to maybe seg into that?
Sure thing.
Unless you guys have anything else to say about gangster movies.
I'm good.
You good? All right. Gangster Squad. I'll kick this off. Mickey Cohen, played by Sean Penn, is beginning to basically take over L.A. He's a mobster, former boxer, who is moving in to control the crime rackets. In doing so, he is basically killing everyone inside. Innocent citizens are getting caught in the crossfire. The police chief, played by Nick Nolte, goes to a hard-charging, honest cop, played by Josh Brolin, says, make yourself a task force of guys who will operate outside the law. This is war, and you won't have badges, but you'll have more freedom. So he collects up a group of guys, and they kind of do their thing, but there's also a forced complication because one of the guys in the gang, played by Ryan Gosling, falls for Mickey Cohen's girl, played by Emma Stone. And that's how it all comes together, where the gangster's like, we're going to war, and Mickey Cohen's like, no. It's light entertainment, but I really like that period. I do think it's glamorous. I like that element. I find L.A. Noir to be one of the biggest disappointments in recent memory, because it has such the potential to deal with that cool, interesting – it has the setting going for it, and I hate that.
Press B. Press A.
Is this person lying? I don't fucking know. Am I fucking –
it's a video
game.
Am
I fucking Encyclopedia Brown over here? Maybe. I'm sorry I didn't catch your face technology. But Gangster Squad – for the talent it has, mm-hmm. has a borderline serviceable script. Some people really hated Gangster Squad. I didn't hate it. I thought it was a bit of a letdown.
Expectations.
I really did not like it.
Oh, you didn't like it?
No.
Okay, Adam, go to town.
Well, okay. At the beginning, it's Ryan Gosling's got the voice, and it was kind of weird, and I was like, okay, like, it's
I really
a
thought
series.
That's the way he sounds.
No, it's normally. And this is why it makes sense, because it was, at the beginning, it was established that this was going to be, like, pulpy, larger than life, kind of cartoonish, kind of like a, you know, like one of those old serials. Like, they sure. even, like, showed one up in the movie. But then, you know, after the first act, Ruben Fleischer decides to make, like, a serious, dramatic movie, and it's just terrible. It's like, it's paint by numbers. You know, every single move that's going to happen, it's like, oh, this guy's reluctant to join the squad. I wonder if someone he knows is going to get killed, and then it's going to become personal. And then, oh, you know, I bet someone on the squad is going to, you know, drop dead so that it becomes personal for them when they go after Mickey Cohen.
Well, and, yeah, you know. What's even more amusing is that these numbers have kind of already been painted by another film that I'll be recommending.
And to me, it felt like Ryan Gosling and Sean Penn were the only people that knew. Well, I feel like they knew that it was supposed to be larger than life.
Well,
and
I also think Robert Patrick is kind of in on the joke because he's like, I'm a gunslinger and I got the – and there are moments where it gets light again. I think in the second act there is some humor to it where
– There is but it feels weird because it's like Fleischer doesn't know what he wants to do serious or pulpy, and so you know, have like the Michael Peña character come in. And another thing, like – the majority of this cast is just, you don't even know who the hell they are. It's like, oh, there's black guy with knives is back again.
He really is. I like how he uses the knife. Like, it's like, that's what he, and it's so, that's a pulpy thing. It's like, he spends his time with throwing knives. It's like, first off, those are switchblades. They're not throwing knives. Secondly, it's that kind of thing where he must practice a lot to be that good with knives. So that's a pulpy element.
If he had committed like 100% to the pulpy, I feel like it would have been better. Like, immediately after seeing it, I thought, you need someone like Baz Luhrmann to just direct the hell out of this and go like 1,000% in the weird, crazy, wacky direction. And that way it might have been okay. Because when it tries to be serious and then you put Emma Stone and Muriel Enos in these just thankless female roles.
Oh, God, they're horrible. And those are the dramatic points that drag it down.
No, and it felt like offensive to me to see them do it, like to see the way they treated women in this. And I know, like, in the 1940s, you know, there was like The Homemaker, but this movie isn't a movie that's striving for authenticity. So,
and also wasn't made back then. I mean, when we're talking about the 1930s films, they are taking place in the present day for them. That's just going to happen. And yeah, so I agree. And it's a waste when you get actresses that talented. When you get a cast this talented. It's really infuriating.
Yeah, and I mean, Ryan Gosling was funny, and I felt like the only times that I felt emotionally invested were, you know, the one of the scenes in the beginning of the film when he finally gets drawn in. I felt like that, and that's, again, the visuals were cool. Like, Fleischer has proven that he's good with visuals, and I felt like some of the stuff showed promise, but it just became predictable, and you just didn't really care about any of these people. Because, again, it's like, oh, black guy with knives, Mexican guy. Joshua.
That's racist.
But accurate. He has no purpose.
He really doesn't.
The entire movie.
Which is so frustrating after seeing him in something like End of Watch. Or even his last film with Ruben Fleischer, 30 Minutes or Less. He steals the hell out of that film. And here he's just like, let me hold your arm, Robert Patrick. Where Robert Patrick gives him, and again, I think this is funnier when it's more entertaining. Robert Patrick basically, for shooting advice, gives him the same advice you'd give to someone who's playing Space Invaders. Don't shoot where it is. Shoot where it's going to be.
But it worked.
It worked. No, absolutely.
I think that was the problem, was the expectations going into it. A lot of people, I don't think, knew how Fleischer was going to take this, because the marketing material was sort of everybody was calling Sean Penn as Mickey Cohen kind of a Dick Tracy villain, because he kind of looked like Big Boy Caprice.
He is kind of a Dick Tracy villain, although I got more – he's more of a Dick Tracy villain.
But he is, and that was my approach going into it. I thought it was going to be a little more pulpy, and I think that was just the tone that I kind of painted the whole film with, so I didn't take it quite that seriously. And like Adam said, it was strictly paint by numbers. And like you said, Matt, it wasn't even paint by numbers. It was like showing a paint by numbers that somebody else had already done, and you just like put your name on it. There were no chances that were taken, but I still enjoyed it just as like a fun.
Right, exactly. And I think I'm on the same page with you. Like, it's not that it made a lot of I wasn't surprised by it, but when it was doing action, which I think plays to Fleischer's strengths, mm-hmm. it was fun, and I think that gets away from sort of the, again, borderline serviceable script, because you get to that, there's this great scene, sort of a Copacabana scene, where it's a raid, and it's set really well. It's paced great, it's exciting, and it's that kind of thing you want more of. It's just when it has to go through the paces of a story, it really is very simple. And it makes me nervous because Will Beale, who wrote this, is now writing Justice League.
Right. Yeah.
And we can just – although you, at this point you would kind of like, oh, it's Warner Brothers. Yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds about right for how Warner Brothers knows how to handle their properties, where it's like, let's just smoosh all these Green Lantern scripts together. It makes no sense. Off you go. It really is. That's a horrible, horrible screenplay, and yet it's the perfect trailer movie. When you think about it, it's a film where as long as you don't see how the scenes fit together, it looks like a great film.
Well, and my expectations weren't even for like a great – like I saw this after the reviews come out, and I saw that a lot of people were upset with it. And so as I was – my problem was that the tone just wavered. So I was like – I was watching it and I was like, okay, it's pulpy. I don't think it's done particularly like really well, but it's pulpy. And then it just kind of like jarringly went serious, and then the serious scenes were like laughable. Like it was just kind of weird because it was kind of maintaining some of that whole hokey dialogue mm-hmm. in the serious scenes. And it just like took me out of the movie. I was like, well, this is ridiculous. Like,
is this one of those instances though – not to start ragging on Will Beale. Maybe is this one of those instances where the director and the script are at cross purposes? For instance, I'm thinking of Jennifer's Body, where Diablo mm-hmm. Cody clearly wanted to make a Heathers kind of film, and mm-hmm. Karen Kusama wanted to make a straight-up horror film. And that did not work at all.
It's possible. I mean, Fleischer said that his stated goal with this was to make a really fun – he wanted to make a fun, flashy gangster movie, which I don't – and I had like seen that interview before I went in the movie, so I was like, okay, it's going to be fun and flashy, but it wasn't.
You lied to me, Fleischer.
I didn't even think like – I mean, some of the action scenes were really well done, but some I thought were like the action – like the car chase scene. I didn't think –
oh, that was not good, but the Chinatown scene was good.
The digital – photography was really bad – was really distracting too.
At least it's better than Public Enemies, which is just grainy garbage.
Yeah.
Did you shoot this with a fucking camcorder, Michael Mann? Let's just keep ragging on Public Enemies. Let's just do that.
I can't remember, it might have been Devin Faraci, said it was the like only instance he sat there wishing it was in 48 frames per second. Because the motion blur was so crazy, which I would agree with in some parts, the motion blur was really bad.
Well, I mean, and that's just the thing where you can wish for it to be in 48 frames per second, or maybe you can just wait for it to be better. Maybe wait for it to be a better, you know, shot action scene. Because even with like the motion blur, it was very hard getting a sense of the geography of where characters were in relation to each other.
Yeah, and Fleischer, after Zombieland, Fleischer was offered a lot of movies, and he said that he wanted to do another smaller movie to get his bearings. Like, he didn't want to jump right into something big and fail. And so that's why I thought that, okay, he's got two movies under his belt. He's going to be fine with Gangster Squad, but I guess not.
Where do you think what do you think happens to him from here? Because Gangster Squad tanked.
Yeah, and 30 Minutes or Less tanked. So
now what happens to him?
He's got just Spy Hunter, and he wants to make like a – he said he wants to make a flashy, like fun and funny spy movie with Spy Hunter. But if this is his version of a flashy, fun, funny gangster movie – I don't think studios are going to bite.
Well,
say this. Like, this thing was just all about style, too. Like, everything in the actual film, like, all the visuals were all about style. I think that was almost – not to a distracting
Fleischer,
level, but that's what I took out of it.
I think Fleischer, if you do look at Zombieland, I think I'm starting to get the feeling if you pair him with a good script and give mm-hmm. him enough freedom, because 30 minutes or less is funny – but A, it's way too – it's so short, and marketing gives away mm-hmm. gives away so much, which isn't really his fault necessarily that the marketing gave away about a quarter of the film. But there's also – 30 minutes or less doesn't really give him the freedom to – with style. There's not a lot of style in 30 minutes or less. It's a much smaller film. I think if you can give him the right script – so if you get the guy – I forget who wrote Zombieland. But they wrote a script that was fun and peppy enough that gave – Fleischer room to be that stylish. When you have a character going through rules, well, hey, why not put the rules on screen and like sort of put them in there and have some – get a little more fun with it. And I think, again, with Gangster Squad, we might have had a director and a screenwriter at cross purposes, and that created what Adam, you felt is sort of a film that's pulpy and then goes serious and it's tough to reconcile the two because it doesn't know what it wants to be.
I think part of the weirdest part of Gangster Squad for me was, I don't know if it was Beale or if it was Fleischer or a combination of the two of them, but it was almost like they took scenes that they really liked from movies when they were like growing up or just 80s, 90s movies and just sort of reworked them in a way for Gangster Squad. Like there were a lot of things that I was like, oh, I've seen this exact scene before. It's just now it's got a 40s or early 50s aesthetic to it. Like there's a fight at the end that's like straight out of Lethal Weapon.
Oh,
there's
yeah.
There's a line from Mickey Cohen that's pretty much straight out of Scarface. He just changes it up a little bit. You know, the idea of like putting this kind of squad together is straight out of Untouchables. They're just like, it's almost like a jigsaw puzzle where he just took pieces from different movies that had similar.
Right, but there's nothing that makes them coalesce. It's more of like almost a clip show.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Right.
Just with his kind of flair on it.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, it's kind of fun. I mean, it's called Gangster Squad, but we've already established it's more of a cop film because the gang aspect of it is more like Mickey Cohen's hatching a plot. But it's really only at the outset that you see how much havoc the gang is Mickey Cohen's gang is wreaking. Because that's also another thing about...
Yeah, you don't really see them do anything.
Right, that's the other thing about the... Yeah, for a city at war, things are pretty quiet after that opening. And that's something with the gang, it is a business. And jumping back to our previous conversation, when you look at The Wire... And those gangs, you have Stringer Bell saying, we don't need, if we're dropping bodies, we're attracting police attention. That's what we don't want. If we go with non-lethal crimes, we tend to stay under the radar because there's just different values attached to what we're doing. Whereas, and again, so in Gangster Squad, you have Mickey Cohen trying to, I'm Mickey Cohen and I'm going to be, you know, say mean things before I fuck you up. But it's that kind of thing. But he does calm down. I think the Gangster Squad may be to blame for all this violence. It's a subversive film and we're just not giving it credit, are we?
Yeah, something like that. Something like very that. Subversive.
Exactly.
It just felt like a waste. I mean, you get that cast together. That cast is great and, you know, it just felt like how did this happen? Like, there could have been so much more there.
I think if they would have gone one way or the other, like if he would have done an actual serious like period piece, Gangster Squad versus sort of the gang, or if he would have gone the other way and just gone completely pulpy, I think it could have been better. But the fact that he was just sort of stuck in between and didn't know which way to go with it, or like Matt suggested, maybe there was a contradiction between the writer and Fleischer. I don't know. But we got what we got.
All right. Well, I think that's the best way to cap off that Gangster Squad conversation.
We got what we got.
Boom.
2013's off to a good start.
Yeah. Well, is 2013 always ever off to a good start? It's January. It's early January.
Yeah.
Although I will say favorite film of last year came out in January. So.
The Devil?
Yeah.
What?
The Devil?
The Gray. The Devil Inside was my The Devil Inside was my second
Devil
favorite
Inside.
Movie. all right, let's kick it off with the recommendations. Adam, what do you got for us?
I know that Dave and Matt are both recommending gangster movies this week, but since we haven't given it, we haven't really found the time to talk about it on the podcast, and it's opening in wide release this weekend, I'm recommending Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty. This is a movie that I didn't see it until early this year, so it wasn't on my top 10 of last year, but it most definitely would have made that top 10. I feel like it's an excellent film, but it's also a very, very important film, and I feel like it's something that everyone should see. Obviously, it focuses on the decade-long manhunt for Osama bin Laden, and it does work very well as a gripping and thrilling procedural that, you know, gets to that end. But Bigelow and screenwriter Mark Boal layer it with all these different pieces that raise so many questions for the audience that I feel spark like a lot of really good conversations. I've had a lot of really great conversations come out of people who have seen this movie because, yes, there's torture in it. It's almost like a journalistic piece. Mark Boal, you know, went to all these CIA sources to create the script, and this is how it happened as he sees it. In fact, in one of the books that one of the Navy SEALs came out with called No Easy Day, he remembers seeing a woman CIA agent crying on the plane back when they were finished. And you'll see that in, you know, shades of that in this movie. But I feel like, you know, it asks all these questions that, like, is it worth it if we use torture to get Osama bin Laden? What does it what does it really – what is the real purpose of getting bin Laden? Well, are we better off? It's also an excellent snapshot of our country post 9/11, and it shows kind of how America has forever been changed and how our outlook on the world has changed. We see kind of, we see Jessica Chastain's character change, go through this really, really subtle arc throughout the film, because there is no backstory for any of these characters. We don't follow any of them home. There's no relationship drama. And Jessica Chastain just does this great work of layering this subtle arc throughout the film of, a newbie CIA agent at the beginning and what she's become at the end. And, it kind of asks, is this worth it? And I just feel like it's a really, really important film, and I feel like people should see it and people should give it the benefit of the doubt. It does not advocate torture. It shows what happened and asks you to come to your own conclusions. I feel like it's important to show that in the movie because it creates all these conversations that I feel need to happen and are conversations with not easy answers. It raises a lot of questions that don't have easy answers. So definitely go seek it out. Watch it with different eyes than just seeing, the hunt for bin Laden and, roo-rah, we got him. I think that's kind of on surface level, that's what it looks like. And I feel like people might be disappointed because there's a lot more there. And I urge you to go and look for what else is there. So,
all right.
Zero Dark.
Was it a better film than Argo, in your opinion?
Yes.
Just film-wise,
no,
not
I know that the question wasn't for me, but yes.
No, that's for either of you, because you saw it, I didn't see it yet.
I think they're both very good movies, but Zero Dark Thirty offers a lot more to chew on. And Argo does raise questions of its own, but this, I feel like this, again, it's...
Wait, what questions does Argo raise?
Yeah, that was my only complaint with Argo.
It's
like
a pretty light film. It's a good thriller, like, oh, okay. And you go on, and then you go about your day. I feel kind of the same way about Lincoln, to be honest. I think Lincoln's a really good, really entertaining film. It's a bit deeper than Argo, but I'm sorry, I bring Lincoln and Dave, you brought up Argo just briefly into this conversation because on The New Yorker, Jane Mayer and Amy Davidson, they were both sort of like against Zero Dark Thirty because they can perceive it as pro-torture. And they're like, why can't it be more like Argo or Lincoln? And I'm like, because those movies are very upfront with you. They tell you how to feel. And Zero Dark Thirty isn't handing it to you. And it's not pro-torture. But it's also saying, we did torture people. And I'm sorry that that's historical fact. And I'm sorry that that leads you to a complicated place where you may want to say torture didn't lead us anywhere. But there was a mix there. As Zero Dark Thirty presents it, there's a mix. And it's a dramatic license as well. But you have to really wrestle with things with Zero Dark Thirty, whereas Lincoln and Argo feed you what you're supposed to get.
Yeah, I would say Lincoln and Argo are a movie – Argo especially is a movie with a capital M. It's very entertaining. The questions I was talking about that it raises is more of like America's place in the world and Middle East and our relations there and how we deal with other countries. But it doesn't ask very – I wouldn't say it asked very
thoughtful. Right, you're not going to have a really long conversation about Argo.
No, and it's very – I might even go so far as to say it's a circumstantial question that it raises. I wouldn't
– Say that the film is asking it consciously.
Yeah. I wouldn't say that it was thinking that Affleck was thinking that he was putting these things in there. And that's why I think Zero Dark Thirty is so great because it's so subtextual. Like you almost don't even see it until after the film and you start thinking about it. There's so many and in the raid there's – someone that's walking through the house at the end of the raid and the look on his face is just kind of like, we killed these people and we killed bin Laden, he's a bad guy, yeah, but to what end? And so
right.
I don't know, I think it's ridiculous that Bibble wasn't nominated for best director.
And I think it really was a sabotage campaign where this phony, it's pro-torture argument, and I think there's also some sexism mix in there as well.
Yeah, I would agree.
I guess you can make – on the one hand, I'm happy that Ben Zeitlin got it. I can understand the love for Amore, although I find the film kind of obvious. I mean, it's a powerful film, but there are moments in it where I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, there's this random shot of Amore of this woman just vacuuming. It goes in there, it's like, what the fuck? It's like you're lingering on a shot of a woman vacuuming. And it's not – it's just the maid. It's not a central character. There's the maid. And then there's another scene where a bird flies into a house, which is like just a common thing of like death is coming. It's like, oh, wow, thank you. I didn't know that the dying woman might not recover with the bird flying in. So I don't know. I think Amore, that for me is a film that I get it. I get the love, but we'll see. I agree. Bigelow deserved it. Affleck, it was a well-made film, but I can understand him not getting it. I think Bigelow was robbed. Dave, what do you got for us?
I'm going to recommend a film today that's every bit as serious as Argo, Lincoln, and Zero Dark Thirty. It's 1990's Dick Tracy from Warren Beatty. Very serious film. This is what Gangster Squad
film with a yellow trench coat.
With a giant yellow trench coat. This is what Gangster Squad could have been if they wanted to go the full pulpy route. Again, this was 23 years ago now that this came out, but it was based on a comic strip series, Dick Tracy. It was created in the 30s, and it dealt with, like Matt said, a detective in a bright yellow trench coat and hat and a Tommy gun and all kinds of good stuff, good gangster stuff you'd expect from the 1930s. The villains in this are completely insane. They have some crazy names. Like, what was it? Prune Face, I think, was one of them. Mumbles, played by Dustin Hoffman. Well, there's the blank. I think No Face. I don't know if they're the same one or not. But Big Boy Caprice is the main guy. He's kind of like the Mickey Cohen character of this. But he was played by Al Pacino in Dick Tracy. So the cast on this was maybe not quite comparable. But, you know, you have Warren Beatty, Al Pacino. Madonna plays a crucial role in this one. Dustin Hoffman, William Forsythe, Paul Sorvino, Dick Van Dyke has a role in here as well. So casting might have been comparable. The pulpiness definitely went to a whole other level. And they kind of embraced it. And I think the film definitely took knocks because of that. But I think if you kind of watch it again from the perspective of you're watching a comic strip just kind of come to life, then it's a lot more enjoyable. The premise is pretty straightforward. Dick Tracy tries to bust up Big Boy Caprice's plan to kind of just like take over the city. There's a love triangle that's involved as well. One of the weaker moments, I think, is Dick Tracy's kind of sidekick, who's just nicknamed Kid. He gets rescued from a crime gone, a job gone wrong early in the film, and then he ends up kind of saving the day at the end, which I thought was a bit hokey. But again, if you're just going to watch it from a pulpy comic strip kind of angle, it's definitely an enjoyable film. So check out 1990s Dick Tracy.
All right. I'll finish up with a film that I feel bears strong resemblance to Gangster Squad, 1987's The Untouchables. In my review, I mistakenly said 1990. If that made the review impossible to like...
How dare you?
It was a mistake, and I apologize for getting too deep.
If we're pointing out your mistakes now, it's Tony Montana, by the way.
It's Tony Montana! God, I don't know anything. Guys, I'm sorry. This is the last episode of The Collision. We're done. My facts are just not good enough. Okay, 1987's The Untouchables. It is a film where another gangster is creating havoc in a city. This time it is Al Capone, played by Robert De Niro. So first similarity, you have a 2-time Oscar winner playing a hammy as fuck real villain placed off a real life gangster. Then at the near the beginning of the film, there's an explosion that kills a small child. And because a young person dies, it spurs action in the city. So Elliot Ness, played by Kevin Costner, is called in to stop to enforce prohibition in the city, because that's what is causing the violence and it is the law. At first, he just does not do a good job. He doesn't have the respect of anyone. He doesn't understand how the game is played. And then he runs into a beat cop, played by Sean Connery, who won Best Supporting Actor for his performance here, named Malone. And he sort of guides Elliot to sort of the best way to bring down Capone. And it's really just a four-man force. So it's those two guys. Then Charles Martin Smith plays this sort of accountant, this nerdy FBI accountant, who realizes early on that they can get Capone if they just get him on his taxes. They just need proof of that. So even though that's not a glamorous thing, it's like we're going to get him for murder. Nothing like that. But it's a good goal to have. And the characters go after it. And then the fourth member is sort of a rookie cop who gets drafted for the Treasury Department, because that's who Elliot Ness works for, played by Andy Garcia, and he's very good. And because there are fewer characters, you feel like you get to know them a little better, even though there's not a lot of time spent, like, what's your life like? Another similarity, Elliot Ness also has a very supportive and pregnant wife. also, another similarity there. There's also a character that you can pretty much peg is going to die. And so those are the similarities, but I think The Untouchables is a much better film. Amazing performance by Sean Connery. Director Brian De Palma does a fantastic job, keeps it tense, does a good job balancing the action. I think it's one of Costner's more underappreciated roles, because he does such a great job as sort of a neophyte Elliot Ness. Like, he's very Dudley Do-Right, but the road to him sort of becoming experienced doesn't feel too dark or heavy. It's not like, oh man, I don't even know what to do anymore. There's still always an innocence to his character that I find very compelling. So if you see the Gangster Squad, it's like the Untouchables Jr. Seek out the Untouchables. It's on Netflix Instant. So that's my recommendation. Next week we will not be on because Adam and I will be at the Sundance Film Festival. Dave will be in a corner crying.
Chained to a desk.
He'll be riding more tanks with Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, you can't feel too bad for him.
But when we get back the following week, I hope to be talking about Sundance with a special guest. So thank you all so much for listening. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Dr. Claw, MD.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.